The Exchange Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The late Washington Post reporter David Broder was honored last night at an event that presented the first of a new annual award in his name. Broder's colleague at the Post, Dan Baltz, accepted the award for outstanding reporting on national politics at the University of New Hampshire's Rudman Center in an event that also included Washington Post columnist E.J. Dion. The conversation last night was a remembrance of Broder's legendary reporting with a lot of war stories of New Hampshire primaries past, but it also looked ahead to the future of the journalism profession that made Broder famous. Today in The Exchange, we continue that discussion about what new technologies, a new political climate, and a new fractured media landscape mean for the future of journalism in America. Let's hear from you, too. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And E.J. Dion, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you. We still miss you in Washington.
It's very sweet of you to say that. It's been almost 20 years. And Dan Baltz, good to see you, too. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, both of you, you know, as I mentioned, you're here in conjunction with this new David Broder Award. David Broder's family members were here last night, too, which was really special. A gentleman often called the gold standard of journalism. E.J., what was the David Broder way that made him stand out?
Well, there are two aspects of it, and one is entirely personal, which is just the kind of person he was. The first time I ever met David Broder was here in New Hampshire, and I was 23 years old, and it was at a debate, and Broder had just done a whole bunch of reporting, and he ran into the debate all excited. He was always reporting. And he gave all his notes to a younger reporter and said, use these. Now, people who read about journalism are familiar with the term Bigfoot, which is the big established guy, and Broder was the biggest of the Bigfoots, just sort of grabs everybody else's work, puts his name on the story, and it's his. David was exactly the opposite of that. He was an incredibly generous colleague, and I saw that as a 23-year-old, and everything I saw after that just confirmed it. So that's one side of it. The other is that David Broder believed in talking to voters, and not just to steal good quotes, and certainly not to make them look foolish, because he respected the way citizens thought about problems. And you know, one of the stories we were talking about last night is 1991, he organized this big project where all of us went across the country to about five or six cities and spent a week in those communities, talking to voters, going to community meetings, figuring out the mood of the country. And while the polls were saying that President George H.W. Bush looked like on an easy path for reelection, we came back, and with all this reporting, we said, wait a minute, there's discontent out there. And although we didn't know it at the time, what we were writing pointed to the Perot insurgency that happened. And so somebody might say that was prophetic, and David Broder would just say, that's good reporting.
Yeah, that's taking the time and spending the hours talking to just regular folks,
right,
regular folks on the ground. What do you think, Dan Baltz? What's the David Broder way, if you could summarize it like that?
Well, the David Broder way is respect the opinions of others, respect the ideas of others, not to think that he had all the received wisdom in the world about politics. He obviously knew as much about politics as anybody covering it in that day or any day. But his view was there's always something more to learn. And the way you learn that is you go talk to people. And he would talk to politicians, and he would talk to real folks in their houses. And he respected those views, and he figured out what they were really talking about. As E.J. said, he wasn't out there looking for a quote or a soundbite, as you know, it later became known. He was looking to try to understand what it was that people were feeling. He always said that, you know, that an election is the one moment in which a voter ought to be able to get questions answered about the things that they care about. He always said that elections belong to voters, not to politicians, not to candidates, and not to the media. And he always operated on that. But the other is he created, and EJ's story about sharing notes is so apt, he created a culture of collegiality among people who covered politics, particularly the team at the Washington Post, which is always we've always prided ourselves on being a very collegial group. And David was the paragon of that. I remember after he died, I got an email from a reporter who had been at the Los Angeles Times. And it was on the day of the 2004 primary in, I think it was South Carolina. And this reporter said he was on the bus, and David was on the bus with John Edwards that day. And the reporter was saying to David, I have to prepare two different versions of the story because I don't know who's going to win, and we don't have any exit polls. And we had subscribed to the exit polls, and this person said to me, middle of the afternoon, David walked back to the end, back of the bus where he was sitting, opened up his notebook, and showed him what the exit polls that we had gotten said about the race, and he said, I think you only have to write one version of the story.
So
and
he shared with that reporter shared, from the LA Times.
And this reporter said, I had never known David Broder before that day or that week. I mean, it was not as though this was a longstanding relationship. It's just the way he was.
Well, and picking up on what you said, it sounds like, Dan, he didn't have a preconceived notion of what the story was. Even though he knew so much and he covered politics for so long, he just entered the story saying, all right, I'm going to listen to people and they're going to tell me what the story is.
Yeah, I mean, he was always open to the idea that whatever view he might have formed could be wrong. And as you all know here in New Hampshire, things can change rapidly in a political campaign, and we've seen it many times up here. And he was always open to that. Now, it didn't mean he was always right. I mean, I remember in 1984, he was convinced that Walter Mondale, as was everybody else at the time, was going to win the primary here. And Gary Hart came out of nowhere in the final few days and ended up defeating Walter Mondale in that. But David was always looking for evidence to change his mind. He wasn't always looking for something to reinforce the view he had. He was quite willing to see something and say, you know, I've got this wrong. I remember we redid our coverage of that primary in the last couple of days as the Hart surge took force.
Well, that's a very humble attitude, isn't it, EJ?
It is. And humble is not a word that most people associate with journalists.
Especially
columnists and pundits. And David kind of played this interesting role that I don't think very many other people will play anymore, which is he was in both ends of the paper, you know, because he had a column. And yet he also was a day-to-day journalist. And there was an irony here. We talked before the show that David was concerned about the blurring of lines between journalism and opinion. And indeed, you know, if you look now on many of the sort of chat shows, it's hard for a viewer to distinguish between the political consultant, the politician, the journalist reporter, and the journalist columnist. The opinionated columnists are all there as kind of equal. So what does that mean? And David was bothered by that. But yet at the same time, he was someone who did have a column. And while he tended not to write it with a sharp edge of opinion, inevitably an opinion column has to be an opinion column. So in a funny way, he pioneered in certain respects a development in journalism which in other respects appalled him.
Really interesting.
Well, and the other aspect of that is David had such credibility as a reporter that even people who would read his column and have a different view, political people on whatever side of the aisle they were on, believed that in his reporting he would be entirely fair with them. So he had the ability to be able to be an opinion columnist without losing the credibility of being a very fair-minded reporter.
I want to pick up on that a little bit later in the show for sure, EJ, this blurring of the lines, because that's a big theme that we hear about these days. Let me also invite our listeners, though, to join us. Our number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. We're sitting down with two leading Washington Post writers today on the Exchange, Chief Correspondent Dan Baltz and columnist EJ Dion. They're in New Hampshire. They were at an event at the Rudman Center last night, honoring the late David Broder. We're getting their thoughts on how political coverage has changed, especially of events like the New Hampshire primary. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. So, Dan, back to you. In light of what you guys said about David Broder, you know, knock on the last door, talk to the last person, don't prejudge the story. How did he feel about the New Hampshire primary?
He loved the New Hampshire primary. I mean, he loved the New Hampshire primary, I think, above all other political events. There was something about the culture of this state that he admired and respected, and he loved to come up here. And so we always joked. I mean, Iowa obviously has the first caucuses that start the political process, and David would always send us off with a little wave and say, I will be waiting for you in New Hampshire.
Wait, he wouldn't go?
Well, he would go some, but he didn't devote the kind of time to Iowa that he did to New Hampshire. And I think it's because, Laura, that he believed that New Hampshire was a more important test in the early stages of a presidential campaign. It is a primary. It's not a caucus, so it has a larger participation. And I think he felt that the tradition of the New Hampshire primary, which predates Iowa's caucuses, gave it a kind of a special place. But I think he just also liked the people here. He enjoyed the town hall meetings. He made friends here over the years. He was very comfortable up here. It's a state where, as a political reporter, you can see a lot in a relatively short amount of time.
Yeah, it's not that big a place.
The distances are not like they are in Iowa. And so for a whole series of reasons, he just loved the place.
I definitely want to hear some of the stories of you guys and David Broder covering the New Hampshire primary. But to the caucuses, EJ, you know, I was explaining to a younger colleague yesterday the difference between the New Hampshire primary and the Iowa caucuses. And I think the media has conflated the caucuses so much that people don't really understand it's not really a vote.
No, these are
very
different.
And I'm biased here. I mean, you know, obviously, I think the New Hampshire primary is more legitimate.
Well, look, for anybody who's come to New Hampshire as often as Dan and I have, we just have a moral obligation to quote former Governor John Sununu's line. I've heard him say it about 100,000 times, Iowa picks corn and New Hampshire picks presidents. I hope he's listening out there. The reason for that is that the Iowa caucuses, particularly in the Republican Party, though to some degree in the Democratic Party, represent a much narrower slice of the Iowa electorate, let alone the general electorate. In the Republican Party, the caucuses are significantly heavier in Christian conservative voters. One reason why, for example, Mike Huckabee did so well there, or Rick Santorum did so well there. A primary, you just go...
Yeah, hold on 1 second, because I definitely want to make that distinction after a super short break. So stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with Washington Post journalists Dan Baltz and EJ Dion about the state of political coverage in American media. Join us 1-800-892-6477. The two men are in New Hampshire this week for an event at the Rudman Center that took place last night, honoring the late columnist from The Washington Post, David Broder, often called the gold standard of political journalism. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And EJ Dion, before we go to our listeners, I did want to let you finish up. Even some people in New Hampshire who are newer to the state don't understand the real important difference between a primary and a caucus.
Right. At a caucus, you have to show up. You go to a long meeting. You publicly declare who you are for. And under Iowa's rules, there are all kinds of rules about it in the Democratic Party about whether you have enough people there to support your candidate. So it's very complicated. Here, it's just a ballot. Like a regular election, you cast your vote. I also think one last big difference is the role independents play in New Hampshire, because you can vote in either primary in New Hampshire. And that really struck me in the 2000 primary, where you had John McCain win his huge victory over George W. Bush, but you also had Al Gore narrowly beat out Bill Bradley. And I spent a lot of that primary out in the other part of the state, out near Hanover. And you know, what was clear to me is there was a whole different primary going on between Bill Bradley and John McCain for independent voters. And I think the biggest mistake Bill Bradley made was to forget that he was not only in competition with Al Gore, he was in competition with John McCain. And if he could have pulled a few of those independents that McCain won over to the other side, he would have had a shot of winning that Democratic primary.
Well, that's really interesting. Yeah, go ahead, Dan.
As a Midwesterner, I want to defend Iowa a bit here. I also love New Hampshire. The reason that Iowa is valuable in the same way that New Hampshire is valuable is that it is one of the two states where candidates actually have to talk directly to voters. And that doesn't happen in almost any other state. And so Iowa is a test of organization more than anything else. So you're trying to get a small number of people to come out on a winter night. So the difference between a small caucus and a large primary is significant. But it is a state like New Hampshire that does put its candidates through the paces. And as they say, you know, kicks the tires and checks the windows and everything else. So there is a similarity and a value to both of them. But David's view was that this is a larger electorate. As EJ says, there the independents play a more significant role, and it provides a better clue as to who's likely to be able to win a general election.
If you won't cut off my microphone, you have to express one heretical thought here in New Hampshire, which is there is a problem with this, which is neither Iowa nor New Hampshire are representative of the country as a whole.
Oh, I've got that disproportionate question for you, for sure.
The disproportionate influence of these two states raises questions. On the other hand, a lot of us who would freely say that still look at Iowa and New Hampshire and say, but where else could you have, if you had a national primary, would you ever have a circumstance where a candidate would talk to actual human beings over and over again, sit in living rooms? It's that's totally missing from the presidential process. So even people who might be critical of the unrepresentativeness of these two contests nonetheless welcome the fact that candidates actually have to talk to people up here.
Okay, a couple more questions. I definitely want to ask you about that lack of diversity and so forth that has been raised, and also the idea that independents play a role. Lots to follow up on, guys, but let's go to our listeners. And again, the number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Your chance to talk to two longtime Washington Post political reporters, Chief Correspondent Dan Baltz and columnist E.J. Dion, 1-800-892-6477. In Lyme, Dan's waiting. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to give a short testimony to David Broder's objectivity and selflessness. I was at a big house party in Cornish for John Edwards, and I was very unimpressed with John Edwards. And there were about 50 people there, and way in the back of the room was somebody I used to see practically every night on the NewsHour, on the PBS NewsHour, and that was David Broder. So I, all excitedly, ran up to him and said, gee, I'm glad there's somebody important here. And he
you should be on the radio.
He stared at me and, glared at me and said, no, no. And he pointed to the candidate there in the front of the room, keep your eye on the candidate.
Interesting.
So any idea that I might strike up a friendly conversation with him, you know, and schmooze was quickly dissipated.
Well, it kind of gets, Dan, right, to what Dan Baltz and EJ Dion said earlier. He was suspicious of this sort of celebrity journalism thing. So that's exactly what this story is illustrating. What do you think of that, Dan Baltz? It's a great story. Thank you so much, Dan.
I mean, it sounds exactly like David. When David was out reporting, David wanted to be a reporter. And though he was a celebrity because he was on Meet the Press more than any other reporter and on TV and very well known, when he was out, he wanted to be himself, which was a person with a notebook taking notes and talking to people. He did not want people to celebrate him or to make a fuss about him, or he did not want to get in the way of covering the story. And so, and he talks about that glare. David could have a strong glare about things. And you, I felt it a few times. We always called it the look. He's got the look today. You know, if he was unhappy about something, you could tell in his demeanor that he was unhappy about it.
Well, Dan, thanks for that call. Again, 1-800-892-6477. If you have stories of David Broder, primaries past, or just thoughts about the emerging trends in American political journalism, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. A couple more follow-ups, guys, from our earlier conversation about the New Hampshire primary. At a 100th birthday celebration of the primary held in D.C. just recently, lots of national and New Hampshire luminaries were there, everybody praising the history of our retail politics, giving examples of what you talked about, Dan Balls, you know, living rooms, door to door, and so forth. But you also heard among the people gathered to honor the primary a concern that it isn't what it used to be, whether it's social media, cable television, people being busy, people not caring. What do you think, Dan Balls? How do you view the New Hampshire primary these days? Not that wonderful history, but now.
Well, it's a different event. I mean, we're in a different era, and as you suggest, the type of media we now have is different. I think the intimacy is more or less gone, particularly in those final stages of the primary. I mean, when we all decamp from Iowa and arrive here the morning after the Iowa caucuses, that final week is a political spectacle, and the roads are crowded, the events are crowded. You know, there's more media than you know what to do with. The candidates are insulated from voters. It has lost some of that character that it once had. Now, you know, you're going to see a lot of candidates between now and that period, and there's still an opportunity in these early stages for some of that intimacy that you get. But I think the nature of it has changed. The role of TV advertising is more important than it's ever been. You have to be able to get that message out on television. You can't simply rely, for the most part, on, you know, kind of just shoe leather campaigning. So there's no question that it's different, and you know, we've lost something as a result of that.
It's also become the Super Bowl of politics. Dan told the story last night of someone from, I forgot where, who was in the state simply to see all these candidates because it was the only place you could see. And one primary, a couple back, I was staying in a hotel in Merrimack, and I discovered there was a whole group of sports writers, really prominent sports writers who loved politics and who organized every year to come up to New Hampshire for the last five days.
Well, the Super Bowl's over, so
yeah,
why not?
Yeah, they come up to New Hampshire for the last 5 days to wander around. And so this group of prominent sports writers were here simply to look at the primary, which is only fair since political writers always claim to know about sports. These sports writers may actually know more about politics than we know about sports.
I think, frankly, that's probably one of the reasons that we all missed the fact that Barack Obama was not going to win the New Hampshire primary in 2008. It was such a spectacle in that final week that you couldn't really do good reporting, or it made it harder to do really good reporting.
Well, you know what was ironic, and Dan touched on this last night, is I also, like everybody else, thought Obama was going to win the primary. And I wrote a column for Tuesday's paper essentially saying that. And I actually had to write a column for my next column was, all right, I was wrong. And I wrote why I was wrong. And I realized you could see the signs if you were looking for them. It wasn't just that moment in the debate where Obama said, you're likable enough, Hillary, and everybody watching knew that was a bad moment for Barack Obama.
Or the tier in the cafe
on the
seacoast.
And then the cafe,
the
which
yeah.
was – but also I went to an event where at a school just north of Concord, you know, it was hundreds of people, and Hillary was answering down to the last question. It was almost like Bill Clinton in 1992. She was going to eke out every vote. And the energy that she had, the determination, it was right there. And I wrote in that column, I had it right before me, and I didn't see it.
Well, and getting to what you said about the intimacy, and I want to ask both of you this. You know, I've heard, Dan, people say what you say, that, you know, towards the end, you don't get the intimacy, and that's understandable because there's this crush of media post-Iowa. But in the earlier days, you do get that. I wonder about that, though, Dan and EJ, given that politicians have to be so careful now, even in the earliest stages of their campaigning. Everything you say can be misconstrued on Twitter, can be reposted 1,000 gazillion times on YouTube. I do see politicians, well, I see them more cautious these days. EJ's saying, yeah, tell me about it. It used to be that New Hampshire, you could come here unvarnished. Make mistakes. Who cares? You say something stupid in front of a living room of 30 people, it doesn't matter. Now it does matter because somebody catches it on their cell phone and posts it. So I wonder if the intimacy has been lost even in these early stages, guys. And I wonder what you think. Go ahead, Dan.
Well, I'll tell you a story. There were a couple of years ago, there was an event here honoring John McCain and John Kerry and posthumously David Broder that the Institute of Politics put on. And we did a conversation with McCain and Kerry, which I moderated, and I said to Senator McCain, could you do the Straight Talk Express in this environment? And because we all remember that, and we, you know, the Straight Talk Express, for those who don't remember it, John McCain would get on his bus. He was in the back of the bus. Reporters could go into the back of the bus with him and ask anything for as long as we wanted, and he would answer.
On the record.
Wow.
I mean, he literally would wear you out. I mean, I remember one day I had to get off the bus to get onto the trailing bus in order to actually get my story written because he went on and on. And he would say sometimes outrageous things, but, you know, it didn't matter because there was so much there. And I said to him, could you do that now? He said, I'm afraid I couldn't. And he said, the reason is for the same thing you talked about, Laura, the totality of a video camera everywhere and Twitter and social media and everything else and this notion that one comment gets taken and instantaneously spread around.
Goes
and
viral.
Commented on. He said, I don't think I could do it.
I just wanted to engage in one small bit of nostalgia by contrast to what Dan said, because I think what you both said is right. Last night when I noted that, some people go for religious inspiration to St. Peter's or Jerusalem or Salt Lake City or Mecca. For Dan and me, Epping is that place in the sense that
Epping.
And in the sense that for us, one evening in 1992, Epping crystallized the best of American democracy. We were there, and of course, Epping's a beautiful town. It was a gorgeous white clapboard house on the square. And about 25, 30 people, as I remember, were in a living room to hear Tom Harkin talk on a snowy night. When we saw the snow last night, we felt, they've recreated the scene for us from Epping. And it was just such an extraordinary, wonderful conversation where a candidate, in this case Harkin, was saying what he thought, and Harkin was pretty outspoken, engaged in a real back and forth with voters. That was the idealized view or the ideal view of the New Hampshire primary. And now what you both said is true. There is such a pressure on a candidate not to make a mistake. And it's true in any walk of life. If you spend all your time not trying to do things but try to avoid mistakes, everything is a whole lot less interesting. You probably also can't perform as well. Yeah, right, exactly.
Well, if you're listening to us from Epping or anywhere else in New Hampshire, we'd love your stories, questions about primaries past. We're hearing some great stories today in the exchange from two longtime political journalists. We'd love your stories and also your thoughts about political journalism, some of the changes that we're talking about this hour with E.J. Dionne and Dan Baltz. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. So, guys, it would be real easy for the three of us to sit around and lament and boo-hoo, and it's terrible, but it is what it is. So, Dan Baltz, to you first. Okay, we can lament about what we've lost. What have we gained from all this media and ways of communicating, and it's instant and anyone can have it?
Well, I think that for people who want to pay attention to politics, and there's clearly a very large percentage of the public that wants to, you can do it now much more easily than before. You don't have to live in New Hampshire to feel you can be a part of the campaign as it's unfolding. You don't have to be an Iowa voter who has to go into the middle of the night and cast a ballot in a room somewhere. The democratization of the media has been a very healthy thing. I mean, when EJ and I started out in this business, there were a handful of newspapers and broadcast networks that basically not only created a common conversation, which was probably good, but had, in a sense, a kind of a chokehold on information. We were all seen as the gatekeepers. If it didn't show up in the New York Times or the Washington Post or wasn't on, you know, CBS or NBC or ABC, it didn't exist. And that's no longer the case. And that's a healthy development. And so I think it creates a challenge for anybody covering politics today to figure out how to take advantage of all of the new media that we have, while preserving the kind of values that David Broder brought to political journalism.
Right. So how do you do that? Yeah, go ahead, EJ.
What I was going to say is, while I cherish our Epping moment, I'm very anti-nostalgia. And if you just think about the phone most people have in their pocket, you can get more information on that phone than people used to be able to get from all sorts of other sources. I can read papers from all over the country and the world. I can collect, I can find data. I can answer factual questions instantly. You can see Red Sox and Patriots scores. I mean, there are just all kinds of things that people have available to them. You also have a multiplicity of views that you can find. And as Dan said, it's democratized so that you don't need to be part of some big outlet to find an audience. There are a lot of people who find their own audiences out there. What we've lost that we have to figure out how to recreate is a sense of a common conversation that, you know, we now can even find our own facts. And obviously some facts aren't facts at all. And there isn't necessarily a shared ground where people talk. And if people choose to, they can isolate themselves entirely within their own worldview and only read or watch things or listen to things they agree with. And now I think there's probably less of that than we say. We complain a lot about that. There are a lot of people I can tell from. All the critical comments I get to my column, there are plenty of people who disagree with me who actually
who's still
read
reading
the column,
yeah.
Which I take as a good thing. But still, I do think this ability to isolate yourself from the common conversation is a problem.
So you can find a multiplicity of views, but do you seek them?
Right.
That's the question. Real quick, Dan, what do you think about that?
Well, I think a lot of people do. I mean, I agree with EJ. I mean, there are people who read the Washington Post who don't agree with the Washington Post, and you know, EJ hears from his readers and I hear from mine. And frankly, you often hear much more from people who violently disagree with what you have to say, as opposed to people who want to reinforce your view that you've done the right thing. So
human nature is a constant.
Yeah.
We'll talk more after a short break. Okay, and we'll take your calls to 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Today in The Exchange, two leading Washington Post writers are with us, Chief Correspondent Dan Baltz and columnist E.J. Dion. They're in New Hampshire for an event at the Rudman Center at UNH Law last night, honoring the late political journalist David Broder. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. We've heard a lot of stories about primaries past. We'd love your stories. Also, your thoughts on how political journalism has changed. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter, too, if you'd like. So, Dan Baltz, back to you. You talked earlier about just the ethic of David Broder that was honored last night. Talking to the people, not putting the politicians, you know, above all, but talking to real people, getting the real story, not entering with a preconceived notion of what the story was. How does a young reporter today embody those David Broder values working in this new landscape?
Well, a couple of ways. One is, it is harder to do the kind of door knocking that David pioneered as a reporter. People aren't home. People are more skeptical about answering their doors. So the return on investment of going out into a neighborhood is a lot lower than it used to be. You get less than you used to.
So you've noticed that.
Oh,
just yourself.
Absolutely. And so you have to find other ways to engage with
voters.
Right.
So how do you do it?
Well, I found sometimes going out in front of a library or in a shopping center, that kind of is not terribly upscale, but just where, you know, where average folks are shopping, or sometimes outside of there was, I don't know if there still is, there was a bookstore down in Nashua that I used to go hang out in front of and catch people as they're going. It's a little more difficult because people are in a rush, but that's one way to do it. The other is with our public opinion polling, we get a demographic look at the people who have responded, and we always ask, are you willing to be called by a reporter? And so we do that. It's, you know, it's not face-to-face. It's not quite as good, but you can have a telephone conversation, and people are a little bit more relaxed about doing it that way. So there are ways to do it.
So when the Post does its polling, it may say to some folks, you know, can we call you back as reporters and just get
yes.
your thoughts?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's still possible, EJ, to have that sort of gold standard journalism, to be a David Broder, even in today's kind of fractured, crazy landscape.
It is. And, you know, there is another way to do it. And again, this is particularly where New Hampshire is helpful to journalists, which is there are a lot of political events. Now, granted, they draw more political people than people who are utterly alienated from politics. But the beautiful thing about here is that that's a very broad group of people who show up at an event, and people will show up at an event who aren't necessarily committed to that particular candidate. And I've had here, particularly also in Iowa and occasionally elsewhere, some really wonderful conversations with people, you know, where I got some insight about how people were responding to a candidate. I remember particularly one night a Gingrich event here where Joe Klein of Time Magazine and I at the end of the night ended up having a really wonderful set of conversations. This was when I think it was when Gingrich was running against Romney. And it gave us extraordinary insight, not necessarily into the whole electorate, but why Gingrich was appealing to a particular part of the Republican Party. And I think there are a lot of us, although on that trip, and this goes to the point of the changed media, Joe and I went to some event, maybe where Santorum was, and we thought we were the only two journalists there that night. And we looked at each other and we said, God, we're old and old-fashioned. We showed up to this event.
There's another point to follow on to that. Those events are very valuable. Too often we focus on what the candidate says. Mm-hmm. And if you sort of think about coming at it from the other direction, what are people asking about? What's on people's minds? That can give you an insight as well. And it certainly can educate the candidates. But if you're a reporter only looking at the candidate, you sometimes can screen that out.
And well, also it's yeah. what the candidate says and what people actually hear, which is not always the same thing.
Well, and do they answer the question, which is a whole other thing. But how do you get into this idea of, though, you know, listening to what people say, and of course that was what David Broder embodied. How do you wade through, Dan, what people today call astroturf, you know, hordes of people who only care about one issue, but they've all been sort of bussed in from somewhere?
Well, you can kind of see that. And I mean, I've always been somewhat standoffish about that kind of, you know, public opinion, if you will, quote unquote. I think it's not that difficult to tell the difference between a regular voter with a question and a concern and somebody who represents an organization. And in Iowa and New Hampshire, you know, it's chock-a-block at some of these events. And sometimes, I mean, I think to the detriment of the process, that they get in the way because they show up at every event and they want to ask the same question. And the candidates begin to know them. I mean, they know who they are, and they'll often avoid, if they can, calling on that person if they know what they're going to answer or ask. But so I think that is a problem. I don't know that it's any worse today than it was. I think this has always been with us. Yeah.
Really? So that's interesting because people complain more about it.
There was a group called the Notch Babies. These were the – I don't know if you remember the Notch Babies. When they did the Social Security reform back in the 1980s, there was a particular demographic group, an age group, that got – you know, they got hurt in this process. They clearly had been –
And unfairly.
I mean, there's
were you a Notch Baby?
No, God, no, God, I'm not that old.
These were people like my parents' age. And the Notch Babies had a real case to plead, and they did it. They pleaded it at every possible event. And, you know, there wasn't anything that anybody was going to do about it, and candidates were sympathetic. Today we have it on a variety of things. You know, you pick an issue, and there's a group that wants to pleading their case. But it does get in the way of what the process really ought to be about.
Oh, you know, it is part of democracy. One person's special interest group is another person's set of profits.
Well, sure, the Tocqueville, ETS, you know, the groups in America,
it's a chance. And you know, it is a useful thing about Iowa and New Hampshire, which is, if a group of people, not necessarily paid for by others, have an issue they care passionately about, an approach to education. Some folks here in New Hampshire are working on, you know, how problems with the family families are related to economic inequality. The Bob Putnam's work, a good New Hampshire person, I suspect they're going to be out talking about that. That can be useful, but sometimes it's just manufactured.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. A couple emails, gentlemen, that I want to share with you. This is from Mary in Hancock. She says, it seems there isn't enough teaching in secondary schools about how our governments, federal, state, and local, work. Mary says, do you think journalists can help fill the void by explaining the functioning of government in the context of the subject that they are writing about? And boy, EJ, there's been a lot of conversation about civics education and how people don't get it.
I totally agree with Mary, and I don't think we can fill the gap. I think we can do our best. And most people who teach civics in schools are unhappy with how spotty it is. Now, my kids, all three of my kids took the AP state and local government class. And these classes
were
inspiring.
They were required to at home.
And these were inspiring classes. And I have always thought that if you look at that AP curriculum, that doesn't have to be an AP course. You have within that curriculum the capacity to create a really great civics class where lots of people can understand government. And I am convinced that the kids who took state and local government are more engaged because they took that class. And a lot of times you have particularly inspiring teachers who choose to teach it because they care about self-government, self-rule democracy.
I think Mary makes a good point. And recognizing that I'm not writing, you know, columns or short pieces, I've got this whole hour. But I do wonder, Dan Balls, if reporters could insert a line, for example, covering the nomination process, just very quickly saying, by the way, a caucus is not a primary, it's this. Or in New Hampshire, for example, we have this thing that not every state has where even if a bill is killed in committee, it still gets a vote on the full floor. That's different than in Congress, where if a committee kills it, boom, you're done. So I do wonder if journalists could just insert a little line or two better explaining the whole governmental process, as Mary suggests.
I tried to make this point last night when I did my talk, which is that we're not very good at providing context. We're in such a hurry. We're in such a hurry to get the basic facts out faster than ever because of competition to post on the web. But it doesn't take that much to add a little of that. And I think that the degree to which you do it, readers appreciate it. There's no question about that. They like the fact that you can give them that. And we can do a better job. I agree with EJ. I mean, we can't fulfill the vacuum that's created in the schools. But there is more that we can do in small ways to help people understand the process.
Well, Mary,
and it's a broderism. I
am
so glad she wrote that. A broderism, though, we have to be careful that we're not writing for insiders and that we operate within a political debate. There are a lot of junkies out there who know a lot of stuff, and God bless them because they're our base.
But speaking of political bases.
Yeah, right, exactly. But we should remember, I think our purpose, journalism's purpose, is a small d democratic purpose. And we're writing for more than just people who live and breathe politics.
Let's go back to the phones. And Mark's calling from Laconia. Hi, Mark. You're on the exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
I wanted to mention the fact that I was involved, very tremendously involved, with George H.W. Bush's campaign back in the 80s. And the point I was going to make is former or late Governor Hugh Gray wrote a book called See How They Run, and it was all to do with the retail shoe leather politics of running a campaign in New Hampshire. And I think it harkens to what your two guests are saying, is that pretty much everything's been digitized now. There are not the days that we took George H.W. as vice president up to the North Country for an overnight Today, it's, oh, that's not the Golden Triangle. Of votes are Nashua to Manchester.
Yeah, you're lucky if they come to Concord, Mark, at this
exactly.
point, right? Yeah.
And I think that's what's gone is they show up with this entourage of paid managers or handlers, and the days of being able to say, gee, we really need to spend a day up in the North Country and overnight and get to see some people up there. Are gone. And
yeah. Mark, thank you so much for calling in. Something we talked about earlier. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Well,
EJ, Dan?
I mean, there's an interesting point here, which is he's talking about George H.W. Bush. George W. Bush came to this state and did not appreciate the culture of New Hampshire politics, and he paid a big price for it. I think that he thought and his people thought they could run the kind of campaign they were used to running anywhere, and they didn't recognize that New Hampshire voters put a premium on personal campaigning, and he did not spend the kind of time he needed. And John McCain, you know, lived here for about 8 months, and the outcome was pretty evident as to which person understood the right way to campaign in the state. But he's right that much of that is lost.
Although people, George Bush became president, so maybe it doesn't matter.
Well,
this gets back to New Hampshire primary. Does it really matter?
Well, it. Sure, you can say that about a lot of different states. That you can. I think he was the first to become. Well, Clinton was the first to become president
without winning New Hampshire. Primary.
Even though he said basically he won the
right.
New Hampshire primary.
Yeah, he managed to spin that pretty well.
I have to just ask. By the way, I think both Dan and I own Governor Gregg's book. I wanted Dan to tell the Jack German North Country story, but the poor North Country.
I remember having Jack German was one of David Broder's contemporaries and a great political reporter, and we were up here one campaign, and he said to me, here's some advice. Here's a Germond rule. Never go to the North Country with a candidate who is below 20% in the polls. His theory was, don't waste your time on somebody who's at 3% who happens to go up to Berlin.
Because no one's going to come out.
Because no one's going to come out, and that person's not going to – you want to be with somebody who's a real competitor.
And if you want to catch that person, it's a lot easier to catch him in Bedford.
Right.
Wasn't there a story last night about Newt Gingrich going to the North Country looking for voters? Found two fly fishermen.
Oh, this was in 90,
a river. And
he was up here on a moose hunt. He was looking for.
That's it.
He wanted to see a moose. He said he loves zoos and animals, and so he went to the North Country. And we were driving along the highway, and he saw two people out in a stream fishing, and he decided he would be a man of the people and get out and talk to them. And it turned out that one of them was a Democratic Party official from Vermont who just happened to be in the stream fishing and saw who it was and yelled out, you're the worst Republican since Herbert Hoover. And poor Gingrich was just shocked that,
I hope he didn't take the trouble to get too wet approaching that potential.
He stayed on the bank.
Let's take one more call, gentlemen. And thanks for that last one. Don's in Londonderry. Hi, Don. You're on the exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning, all. This is interesting. Full disclosure, I was a Hillary supporter on the ground knocking on doors back in 07.
You knew what was happening when we didn't.
Right.
So.
You got that right. And it was a lot of fun. I mean, I love it. I can't imagine moving away from the state. But two things about journalism. One, I think one reason Obama was elected, I think, was that journalists nowadays, and it's not just in politics, I think, tend to go too much with the press release and not the old-fashioned digging and finding out the truth. That's one thing. The other thing is you were talking about the helicopter supporters or whatever, and I remember, I think it's the 100 Club dinner, which is just before the primary, and at that one, I was doing the check-ins, and it was out in Milford, and there were all these kids coming in, and I asked them where they were, and they said, oh, the Obama campaign flew us in by plane from Iowa.
Oh, sure. That's always a complaint, isn't it, Don, that supporters come in from across the country?
Right.
They're not voting, though, but they are kind of attending events and making it look like there's momentum there. Is that what you're saying, Don? Kind of manufacturing excitement.
That's an event that traditionally is invitation only, and there's no campaigning there. It's just all the people getting together with all the candidates.
Could I just make two quick points?
Yeah, Don, thanks for calling in.
One is I'm not sure the problem is printing press releases. I think there are still a lot of journalists who dig, and thank God for that. But secondly, on this sort of flying people in, he's right. And that one of the tricky deals is to figure out when is a candidate flying people in to supplement a very strong organization on the ground? And when is it just the only organization there are the people the candidate flies
AstroTurf
in? And
that's that we talked about
what
earlier.
You got to figure
yeah.
out.
Yeah. So if you, as a reporter, you know, go in and say, a packed room greeted candidate so-and-so, and it turns out half the packed room
well,
is
Dan
from, you know, last Colorado.
Dan told about the Howard Dean campaign in Iowa. Right. Where,
yeah. Go ahead, Dan. We've got time real quick. Yeah.
Well, I mean, in Iowa in late 2003, we all thought that the race out there was between Howard Dean and Dick Gephardt. And it turned out, you know, Dean supposedly had this volunteer army of outsiders and people in Iowa, and it turned out to be a mirage. It was a much smaller support group than he had ever imagined, and the Kerry people figured that out early and quietly built their support and actually were stealing voters from Howard Dean in the end, and Howard Dean was turning out people he thought were his voters, and they were voting for John Kerry, who won those caucuses.
Wow.
Which is why politics is so much fun.
Guys, this has been great. Have a safe trip back to D.C. Please come visit us again. It was
and
really
you come back.
Thank you. Thank you, Laura.
That's Dan Balls, chief political correspondent for The Washington Post, E.J. Dion, Washington Post columnist and senior fellow of governance studies at the Brookings Institution. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.